Welcome to night six, the final class of Mackinac Center Candidate University. We appreciate all of you who have taken part in this great experiment. This has been a learning opportunity, not only for all of you about the issues, but also for us how to do a program like this and be able to execute it online. We really appreciate your continued participation and interest. And at some point next week, you will receive a survey from me on the program, the content, and suggestions for how we can make this more useful in the future. So tonight we have two presentations. We have Jason Hayes, who's our Director of Environmental Policy, and Vinnie Vernuccio, our senior fellow on labor policy. So we'll start with Jason. Jason, you are unmuted and you have control of the screen.
Alrighty, I will share my slides.
Before he's getting everything up, remember as always, Alt-H to open the group chat. If you have questions for either Jason or Vinnie, please type them in there and I will pose them to him at the end of his presentation.
Okay. Now, is that working for everybody? Can you see the slides?
Yeah, I can see them.
Okay. So I wanted to thank everybody for joining us tonight. Thank you for the invite to speak on this issue. But I also wanted to say thank you to everybody who's taking time out of their life to stand up and run for public office, because actually doing this is one of the things that really helps make the whole system work. So you folks deserve as much or more thanks than any of us for actually taking part in this. So David asked me today to discuss some of the environmental policy principles that we work on here at the Mackinac Center. And one of the recent publications that we just put out was this thing here on the screen. It's called Seven Principles of Sound Environmental Policy. And so that document, I'm hoping, will give some newly elected legislators some good ideas on how you can be involved in helping to make sure that environmental policy is actually doing the job that you want it to do. And so one of the questions that I want to answer here today is this question that's up on the screen. How can markets help protect our natural environment? And there's oftentimes that question, like, is that something actually that can happen? Because people a lot of the time will say, well, capitalism and free markets, they're going to damage the environment because people are more concerned about just earning a profit or something like that than they are about taking care of the environment. But actually, I hope to show that free markets and are quite good at helping to manage the environment properly. So you're familiar with the Mackinac Center because you've gone through, I believe this is now the sixth edition of the Candidate University. So what I do as Director of Environmental Policy is I try to answer a few questions in everything that I do. So I look at the natural resources, the unique natural features that Michigan has. And what I try to do is make sure that they're maximized. But in maximizing them, we recognize that we rely in Michigan on clean water, clean air, our forests, our fisheries, and a lot of other things to provide the quality of life that we all enjoy. So we're trying to make sure that they stick around effectively, that we have that environmental health. But we also recognize that we need to use some of those resources, many of those resources, to do the things that we need to do every day. So those using our forests, using our water, using minerals from the ground, oil and natural gas and that kind of thing, they're what helps us to keep our economy running. So I try to balance this idea of environmental health and economic vigor. And then on the third bullet over on the right-hand side, I also try to make sure that every citizen in the state has access, equal access to those natural resources and the benefits that they provide. So jumping right into this idea of seven principles for sound environmental policy, the first one that I'll share with you guys is that environmental stewardship starts with individuals. It doesn't necessarily start with politicians or bureaucracies. And so that may seem a little strange when I'm talking to a group of people that are running for elected offices to say, oh, the environmental stewardship doesn't start with politicians. But the reality is that the people on the ground, the people in the communities that are being impacted by policy are the people that live these things every day. So it's their front yard, their backyard. It's the air that they breathe. It's the water that they drink. It's the places where they recreate. It's, you know, where they go hunting or fishing or any of those sorts of things. So it's those people, those individuals that are on the ground in the communities that actually start a lot of these issues and start to deal with them in a positive way. And so as one example, there's a program that's put on by the Nature Conservancy. It's called Bird Returns. And what TNC has done is they've actually developed a smartphone app. And this application, people can use it to track migrating birds, waterfowl and wading birds, and like the birds in the picture on the screen. And so what TNC allows them to do is just say, okay, I saw this species of bird in this location on this day. And so they begin to track as just people on the ground, bird watchers or people who are just interested in birds. And then TNC and wildlife biologists across the state, in this case, it's in California, can begin to understand, okay, the birds are moving here and they're gonna be here. And so what happens is then TNC goes out to rice farmers in the area and says to them, look, we want you to manage your fields in a certain way. And what that way is they actually, after the farmers have harvested the rice, they can go in and literally just kind of churn the straw that's left over up into the ground. And you can see that here in the picture, that the straw is kind of sticking out in a few spots. And they also sort of flood their fields. And what that does is when TNC knows that the birds are headed south, flooding the fields and doing this to them actually provides habitat for the birds and gives them a place where they can forage and they can build nests and that sort of thing. And so normally the farmers wouldn't do that because it's quite expensive to plow their fields up in this way. And so a lot of the time they would have just left them dry. But TNC says, we will pay you to do this. So it makes it worth the farmer's time to do it. And what it does is it provides habitat for the birds. And then as a spin-off benefit, they've actually found that it's helping the fields become more fertile because they're basically composting in there and they're fertilizing their fields. So out of this, you're getting three kinds of benefits: that the birds have habitat, the farmers have better fields that are better managed while they're still getting their crops and they're getting paid to do it. And TNC and their supporters are happy because they're conserving and they're helping the birds. So it's a win-win-win. It's good all the way around. And the important thing here is that I said that it was people on the ground that started this. It was a private company, private farmers that were doing this, and they all set it up. And they didn't need to have regulators come in and say, you need to do this. They didn't need legislation passed. It was completely private and done on their own. So the next, number two, is the idea that property rights are the most basic of human rights, and they're an essential foundation for environmental stewardship. And the example that I have here is a picture from one of the conservancy groups in the Midland area who we're working with on another project. It's called Little Forks Conservation or Conservancy. And what they've done is they've taken a bit of private land that they own and they have turned it into a natural area. It's a nature preserve that's also a recreation area along the banks of the Tittabawassee River, just around Midland. And what it does is it gives people an area in which they can recreate, they can go for a hike, and they can learn a bit about the history of the Tittabawassee River, how it was used to send logs down to Midland and that sort of thing. But again, it's a privately owned area that's managed for a conservation purpose. So privately owned land actually is being used for, you know, this benefit, not only for the public, but also for nature. And the third point here is that competition and voluntary cooperation foster innovation and a wise use of natural resources. So competition and voluntary cooperation will help us come up with things like what you see in the picture here. It's a product called Sense. And actually what you do is you hook it up into your breaker box where your electricity comes into your house. And this little box, and you can see over on the edge is an antenna that hooks up to your Wi-Fi, and it'll actually gauge how much electricity you're using in your home. So the fellow who actually wrote this this paper with me, Todd Myers, said that he has this at his house. And it's funny, when we're sitting at a conference, he will open up his phone and he'll lean over to me and say, look, my wife just turned on the TV. So he knows literally second by second how much electricity is being used at his house, where it's going, how it's being used. And when you match that sort of knowledge up with other technology, like the Internet of Things or smart homes and that, you can actually compare these two up to say, when you're driving off to work, you can say, oh, I forgot to turn on my lights or turn off my lights. You just open up your phone and press a button and you can shut your lights off in your house. So you're completely aware of how much electricity you're using literally moment by moment. And you're also able to control that electricity use so that you can choose to use it in, you know, time periods where the electricity is less expensive depending on time of day and that sort of thing. So again, you're using that competition and voluntary cooperation to develop these sorts of technologies and become more efficient. And efficiency is the key to reducing environmental impacts. And the classic example of this is how we have in life changed from using incandescent bulbs to CFL bulbs to LED bulbs. And CFLs are the compact fluorescents that were coming into vogue about 10 to 15 years ago. So traditionally incandescent bulbs, we all used them when we were younger. They're the ones that if they burned out, you had to wait a few minutes for them to cool down before you could change a bulb because they're too hot. So the way that they produced light was much less efficient in the sense that they also produced a lot of heat. And when compact fluorescents or CFL bulbs came along, what happened was a mix of legislators and regulators came in and said, these are much more efficient. We think these should be used. So we're actually going to pass laws and regulations that in some areas and in some cases made traditional incandescent bulbs illegal or made it so that they couldn't be manufactured anymore. And a lot of people really kind of pressed back against that. And they said, you know what, that's not the kind of thing that we want to have forced into our lives, because the color of the light is very that antiseptic kind of bright blue-white light that a lot of people don't like. They like that warmer kind of yellowy-orange feel from the incandescent bulbs. And so that legislation that tried to force CFLs into people's lives was not taken very well. Now continue on a few years and you end up with the LED bulbs that were all much, they're much more available now. Those LED bulbs now give people a choice, a range of colors and hues and brightnesses and that sort of thing, intensities. So if you look at the scale here, a 12 watt LED bulb compared to a 60 watt traditional incandescent bulb, the LED bulb is 75 to 80% more efficient, costs about 5 times less annually to run, and it lasts about 25 times longer. And the idea behind that is that that was a much more market-driven approach than the CFLs, because the LEDs had not been mandated in the same ways the CFLs were. So it's another example of where efficiency is driven by markets and by customer choice and that sort of thing. People are using LEDs much more now. The next point here is that harming prosperity harms the environment. And the important bit here is that when countries are extremely wealthy, they tend to have very clean environments. And one example here is that something called the environmental Kuznets curve, which was created by an economist whose last name was Kuznets. But essentially the way that this works is if you look, there's environmental degradation over on the y-axis and the stage of economic development on the x-axis. As countries or people get more wealthy, they also tend at the start to have a bit more environmental degradation. So you go from like a Stone Age sort of or pre-industrial economy and very few people using very little technology, and they do very little in the way of impacting their environment. But as people tend to get richer and more industrial, they will start off as we did in the US and the UK. We started using coal and that sort of thing and burning it inefficiently, openly, without filters. And we initially had much greater impact on our environment. But then when you reach that point on the screen that's called the turning point, which is around $4,000 to $6,000 income per capita GDP, then you start to notice that environmental degradation goes down as countries and peoples get richer. And so you see that same sort of thing happening in the United States and in Europe and in Japan and other Asian countries. Our environmental impact grows much less as we become more efficient and more wealthy. We can actually make choices to buy a hybrid vehicle instead of that old ratty beat up 72 Ford pickup. You know, we can choose to drive a more efficient car. We can choose to buy foods that we believe are better for the environment, like some people choose organic food or something like that. You can make those choices because you've got the money and the freedom to do it. So, number six, top-down approaches rarely work. My example here is from when I was fortunate enough to work as a backcountry ranger in British Columbia provincial parks. This is me standing out looking at doing the pose, pointing out into the distance. But in Valhalla provincial parks, one of the key draws to the area was high alpine meadows. And those high alpine meadows are extremely sensitive environments. And so when we were working in the area, we knew that the best way to ensure that people would stay on the trail, like if you have people wandering all across the meadows, essentially what happens is you get the meadows really trampled down, and the lichens and the moss and the small plants that grow there can take decades to regrow. So it's really sensitive. So what we did is we would put up little stone piles called cairns and tell people just walk by the cairn and only go there. And we understand it's going to impact that small area, but that's where we want you to stay. And so we got a letter one day, a memo from that senior management in British Columbia Provincial Parks, coming from Victoria, BC, and the capital city, that told us they had a better way to build the trails in the park. And so what they said is, what we want you to do is go in and scrape out a trail, like literally dig down into the soil. And then we want you, where you dug a trail out, to pile on bark mulch. And we, that way people will know where the trail is. They'll walk on the bark mulch. We said, that's absolutely not going to work, because the first time a strong wind comes through, it's going to blow that bark mulch all over that sensitive alpine ecosystem, and it's going to cause a lot of damage. Plus, when you dig that soil out, you're going to basically create a low-lying mud puddle that nobody wants to walk in. And they were convinced. They knew exactly what they were doing, and they said, no, this is what we want you to do. So we went in and we created one of the trails for them. Poured the bark mulch, and the first time a wind came through, it blew the bark mulch all over the backcountry. And then we were left, like we said, with a low, shallow depression that was full of water that nobody wanted to walk in. And so what they ended up doing was kind of walking to the side of the trail and actually expanding the impact of the trail. So that idea that top-down approaches don't always work is exactly what we were saying there. We were the people on the ground. We were the people with the site-specific knowledge who lived and worked in that area, and we said, it's not going to work. You should probably listen to us. And they said, no, you need to do what we're telling you. So that top-down approach in this case was a good example of not working. So the next bit, technological innovation, is the key to improving the environment. And the bit here, most importantly, because I've already talked a bit about technologies that, you know, competition improving innovation and that, but the bit that I'm interested here is, as legislators, the one thing that you want to avoid is kind of this, we've done things a certain way for many decades. It's what one group calls political environmentalism, where if I want to do something and you don't want me to do it, or vice versa, you want to do something and I don't want you to do it, my solution in the past has always been, well, I can litigate. I can get somebody to pass a law. I can get some regulation passed that will stop you from doing what you want to do. And instead of kind of binding everything up with green tape, which is what this picture shows, you know, the environmental form of red tape is green tape. Instead of binding everything up like this, what we can start to do is look for, you know, collaborative methods, where I said cooperation, voluntary cooperation, you know, technological innovation. We can come up with new ways that don't require regulation and legislation and that sort of thing. Where it's possible to do things like this, we really should be doing that. And so one last slide here, other work that we're doing to give you an example of some of the things that we're working on. There's examples of papers that have already been published on the screen. The Policy Guide to Energy Choice talks about electricity choice in the state of Michigan, why using markets to set electricity prices is a better option. There's another document, Seven Principles of Sound Energy Policy, which is looking at basically the same thing as we just discussed, except looking at energy policy instead of environmental policy. Conflict to cooperation is collaborative management of the state's national forests and ways that we can manage them to avoid the massive fires that we've seen in California and Arizona and those sorts of things. So some of the upcoming studies are listed over here on the side, the UP Energy Task Force report. They gave some recommendations to the governor on propane supply for the state, or we're looking at the cost and viability of those recommendations. The Private Conservation Working Group actually works with two and a few others of those groups that I've already talked about, the Nature Conservancy and Little Forks Conservancy. We're trying to encourage the private conservation work that they're doing. And so hopefully as incoming legislators, you'll be able to use information like that in your work. The cost of utility IRPs to Michigan, the big utilities are going through integrated resource planning processes right now that will govern how they produce electricity in the state over the next 20 plus years. So the idea that we're dealing with now is moving from large baseload generation stations and going to more smaller distributed generation, renewable energy and that sort of thing. And so what we're going to do is use software models to say, okay, it's going to cost this much and how will it work? The Edenville Dam failure report is what caused the dam to fail and where are we going to go from here? Electricity primer is very simply an electricity 101, like where does electricity come from? And where, how does it get to your house or your business in Michigan? And then nuclear energy is just looking at how nuclear energy is used in the state and why and where we could use it better as we go forward. So with that, I'm not sure if Dave wants to do questions and answers right now, but.
Yeah, let's. If you've got questions, you can go ahead and put them into the chat screen. A couple of things that jumped out to me as examples from my time in working in Texas, that when the federal CFL mandate came through that you couldn't use incandescent bulbs anymore, and you had to do the compact fluorescence, there was such hostility toward
those spiral bulbs and the bad light that they produced, and also the hazardous chemicals and the way you had to handle those if they broke or you wanted to dispose of them, that for two or three sessions about a decade ago, there were actually bills introduced that would have allowed for the manufacturer of incandescent bulbs in the state as long as they were not sold outside the state, thus getting them out of the interstate commerce allowed in the Constitution. You've not had those bills come back since there's been the innovation of the LED bulbs and the widespread adoption of those. And then the other piece on technical innovation, there was a refinery near Corpus Christi, Texas, that was one of the innovators or came up with the idea of what they call flex permitting. The way it used to work as far as the air quality was that you had, in order to make sure that the air leaving the refinery wasn't causing threats to human health and things of that sort, that there were something like 3,000 different points within the refinery that the state officials had ordered the company to monitor and require them all to be within the allowable variances. And so you had three employees spend all day going around and writing down readings on the individual gauges and submitting them to the state. What they wound up doing with that information, no one really knows. What the state wound up doing probably about 20 years ago was going to a flex permitting, is that we will let you, as long as you meet the thresholds at the perimeters of your site, you have the ability to determine what makes sense as far as the maintenance and upgrades in order to be able to make sure that the air is within the tolerances. And so you save the cost of all the employees writing down the 3,000 different gauges and then figuring out the way that makes sense, and the refinery wound up being able to address the points where they could get the biggest gain for the air quality. So we do have a question. Why is the water higher in the Great Lakes? Is there any connection to the Midland-Edenville Dam increase in water levels?
I would say no. The water in the Great Lakes has been rising since, it was last year, really, when it was first starting to get high. But the water changes in the Great Lakes are natural. They have been doing this. I've actually written, I think there's one blog post, and I've also been quoted in a couple CapCon, Michigan Capital Confidential, which is our news outlet, a couple of their pieces that basically described, and I'm forgetting the timeline, but there's been a few studies that have been done on this that say it's a normal cycle that happens where, the water goes up and it goes down, it goes up and it goes down. And the heights that the water is at right now, it has been at that level or higher a few times. I mean, back as far as 2,500 years ago, but also I think it was about 180 years ago, it was this high. So it's just nature. Nature does that. And really what causes it is you're seeing right now a mix of rainfall over the whole state. And then depending on the winter, if it's a warm winter and there's not as much ice on the lakes, you'll get more evaporation. If it's a colder winter and there's lots of ice, the water doesn't evaporate off the lakes quite as quickly, so it tends to stay. And then as the snow melts, it just kind of builds up. So it's right now it's difficult for anybody who lives on the lake. It's, you know, kind of frightening and a little bit concerning because their beaches are being washed away and that sort of thing, but it is actually a normal event.
Yeah, it was shocking to go to Sleeping Bear Dunes for the first time and seeing the signs on the top telling people don't go down. If you get stuck, we will have to call in a helicopter to rescue you, and it's going to cost you $3,000. Because there's just no beach between the bottom of the dunes and the waves crashing in.
Right. Yeah, because the water's so high right now.
Yeah. Yes.
So somebody else asked another question. They asked where can we get the booklets to read the information? All of our publications are available on the Mackinac Center's website. So if you go to mackinac.org and you just look right when the web page first starts up, just look for the environment one specifically. You can look, there's a little leaf graphic and just click on the word environment and you will go to that page. And you can just look over on the left side and you'll see our most recent reports. And then look over on the right side and you can see the most recent op-eds and blog posts and that sort of thing. So quite easy to find. And you can do the same thing with Vinny's presentation. You can see the labor reports looking at, you know, the labor section.
And we also have the Canada University webpage, which if you haven't already visited that, I will put it into the chat window. We'll get those up along with the video and audio of this presentation, that you can see the entire program and the resources that go along with them in that portal. So, Jason, if you can just send me those web links, I will get those up on the site tomorrow. And definitely appreciate you being here. And next, we will switch over. Hold on. We will switch over to our presentation on labor policy. Vinny Vernuccio is our senior fellow on labor policy. I also want to introduce you to Steve DeLee. He is the new director of the Mackinac Center's Workers for Opportunity Project. If you are fortunate enough to be elected to the legislature next year and there winds up being labor policy matters in the legislature, Steve will be the person who will be meeting with you and testifying in committees, et cetera. So, Vinny, you're up.
Great. Thanks, David. And you stole my thunder. I was going to introduce Steve. He's fantastic. He is a great resource. And we at Mackinac are really fortunate to have him. As David said, I'm Vinny Verduccio. I'm a senior fellow with the Mackinac Center. Before Steve, I was actually director of labor policy at Mackinac. And I currently serve as a senior fellow for both the Mackinac Center and their Workers for Opportunity Initiative. So thank you all for taking the time. I know it's late. I know you're very busy. I really appreciate you taking the time to learn a little bit about environmental and now also labor reform here in Michigan. Can you all see my screen?
Yeah, we can see it.
Fantastic. So just getting started, want to do a lay of the land of both Michigan and nationally. What are the state of unions? Union membership in particular has been falling, and it's been falling for actually a couple decades. Right now, we're looking at about 13.7% of workers in Michigan are union members. Nationally, it's about 10%. And you can see that the public sector, both in Michigan and nationally, far outweigh those union members in the private sector. But still, you compare those to about a decade ago, and you'll see that drop off, both in Michigan and nationally, where in 2009, about 19% of workers in Michigan were union members, and nationally, it was a little over 12%. But getting away from kind of the statistics, I know it's late. We don't want to be bogged down with numbers. Let's talk about Michigan since Right to Work. Yes.
Hey, we're still on your opening slide, I think.
Oh, that's weird. Hold on 1 second. Sorry about that. Is this any better?
Yeah, we're back on the opening slide.
Okay, are you at State of Unions?
Yes. Okay.
Okay. Michigan since Right to Work, and is that coming up?
Yeah.
Fantastic. So Michigan since Right to Work. Sorry about that, folks. Once again, all this is before the COVID crisis and the pandemic, which has obviously changed things drastically. Hopefully, we're starting to see things get back to some sort of normalcy. We're starting to see jobs come back, unemployment go down again. But the numbers that I looked at for this were obviously before the COVID economic crisis and the shutdowns both in Michigan and across the country. But still, looking at Michigan since Right to Work. And what does Right to Work mean? Right to Work means that a union simply can't get a worker fired for not paying them. A little bit more wonky way to say it is that unions can't make union membership or paying a union a condition of employment. But quite simply, it just means that workers have a right to choose whether a union's doing a good job and if a union is doing a good job. And we're seeing this across the country and in Michigan, that workers are saying, okay, union's doing a good job representing me well, I'm going to pay them. Just like we at the Mackinac Center or nonprofit, we exist on voluntary donations in a right to work environment. Workers choose to support their union. But if they don't think the union's doing a good job, then they can say, well, you know what, we're not going to support them. Right to work is basically that simple, but it also has very strong economic impacts. In states that pass right to work, you see unemployment dropping. In Michigan, unemployment dropped like a stone after around the time that Michigan passed right to work. It was a combination of right to work and a lot of the economic and tax reforms that were put in around the same time that Governor Snyder and the legislature put in. What you saw in Michigan, you see that across the country, is that after a right to work law is passed, incomes go up. Workers start making more. Wages go up. The population in Michigan goes up. I bought my house in 2012. Most recently, I had to move down here to the D.C. area, and my heart is breaking, especially during the summer, missing those Michigan summers. But my property value, I did actually pretty well because property values after Right to Work went up. And now one of the things you hear about Right to Work is, they talk about the wages in Right to Work states. But what you see is that when you compare apples to apples and you factor in a thing called cost of living, so what is the cost of rent, groceries, gas, when you factor all of that in, workers in right-to-work states are actually making more than workers in non-right-to-work states. So right-to-work, it's both good. It's about freedom. It's both good for workers, but it's also good for the state's economy and wages, income, unemployment rates, and population. So right to work now applies mostly to the private sector. And the reason for that is a 2008 case called Janus versus AXME, 2018 case called Janus versus AXME. In 2018, Mark Janus went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and he was a Illinois public employee. He was a child support specialist in Illinois. And he said that everything that his union did was political because it was a public sector union. And basically the argument was that if public sector unions are negotiating over wages, what is that? That's tax dollars. If they're negotiating over, let's say it's a teachers union negotiating over the length of the school day, what is that? That's public policy. So Mark and his attorneys from National Right to Work and the Liberty Justice Center with amicus briefs and help from the Mackinac Center basically said that everything they do is political, and because everything they do is political, he has a First Amendment right to choose whether or not to pay that union because it's essentially a political organization. Essentially, he was asking for a right to work. And in June 2018, we're just about to come up on the two-year anniversary, the Supreme Court agreed with him. And it actually went further than just affirming that everything that these union, that government unions do was political, giving him a First Amendment right to choose, essentially right to work. It also said that in order to collect dues from a worker's paycheck, those public union, those public employers that can take money directly out of a worker's paycheck and give it to the union, they have to have what Justice Alito said was evidence of affirmative consent. In fact, he said it had to be clear and compelling evidence of affirmative consent. Now, what does that mean? Essentially, it means that the employee had to opt in, that they had to knowingly say, yes, I know I have a First Amendment right to not pay, but I choose to. And then give that dues check off, that membership form, instead of to the union, give it directly to the employer. So we call that opt-in. In Michigan, there's actually been legislation for opt-in. And most recently, the Michigan Civil Service Commission has instituted a notice of proposed rulemaking saying that, yeah, you know what, this is what the Supreme Court said. For at least for state employees, we have to make sure that their First Amendment rights are protected. And they issued this NPRM on June 5th, 2020. Comments are due on July 6th. And essentially, they're echoing what attorney generals in Alaska, Texas, Indiana, and other states are looking at right now, saying that in order for a union to have money taken out of a worker's paycheck, simple good bookkeeping, that the employer has to have evidence directly from the employee, that dues check off form, and it has to inform the employee of their rights. And many attorney generals are also saying that that can expire. So, you know, just like you have to renew your insurance every year or things like that, you should re-up your union membership or that dues authorization form. So we're seeing this play out across the country on an executive level, but we're also seeing it on a legislative level. The Florida House just passed a bill to this effect. Bills have been introduced in Kansas, in Missouri, in several other states, in Louisiana, to the same effect. So it's both a legislative and an executive effort to protect the First Amendment rights of public employees. So that's Jasper Zathamian. I know I'm getting a bunch of pings right now, and I'll be getting to all the questions at the end, David, if that's okay with you.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, union recertification. This is another way that protects worker democracy, actually protects union democracy. Most unions, and we're now talking about public sector unions, because at a state level, besides right to work, the only thing that state legislators can do is basically adjust the policy for public sector workers, since most policy is dictated by the federal government for the private sector. So for most of what I'm talking about here, just please keep in mind I'm talking about public employees and government unions and public employers. So with that, union recertification, another one of the Mackinac Center priorities. This simply allows unionized workers, public sector unionized workers, to have a vote on the union that's representing them. Most unions in Michigan were organized decades ago, and the current employees, the current members, never had a chance to say, yes, this union's doing a good job, I want to vote for them, or, well, no, they're not, I'd rather not have them represent me, or, you know, this other union, I'd much rather be with them, I'd rather bring them in. We actually did a survey of the top 10 largest school districts in Michigan, and we found that only about 1% of teachers in those school districts had ever had a chance to vote on the union representing them. So in some school districts, it was actually zero. And, you know, I didn't want to just, you know, report a big fat goose egg. So we actually went through and we looked to see how many employees, statistically, how many employees were even alive when the union organized. And we found that 75% of school employees in those top 10 school districts were probably not even alive when the union organized. So what does union recertification do? It simply says that the union stands for re-election, just like you all are running for election, just like we vote for governor every 4 years, we vote for state legislator, we vote for Congress, we vote for president. Workers should have the ability to vote for their union as well. Legislation to this effect has been passed in Florida, Missouri, Iowa, and Wisconsin, and several other states have introduced it, and it is legislation that looks like it is catching on nationally. Another policy is workers' choice. Like we were just talking about with right to work and union recertification, right to work simply means that a union can't get a worker fired for not paying them. Union recertification will give workers the ability in mass to vote, to say, yes, I like this union, or no, I want a new union, or no union at all. But in both of those scenarios, if the union is still there, whether or not the worker wants to pay, they're still under the union contract, whether they want to be or not. And now what you'll hear with unions and right to work states, and now with Janus, is that, oh, we're forced to represent these workers that don't want to pay us. That's unfair. So what workers' choice does is it simply says that if you are in a, you are working in a job where there is a union, and you don't want to be under that union contract, you want to act, and I'm going to flip around here, like the almost about 16% of workers nationally in Michigan, or in Michigan, or over 50% of public sector workers in Michigan, that you should have that ability, that not only can you opt out of paying the union, but you can opt out of union representation of the union contract, and you can negotiate for yourself. It also frees the union from having to represent people that aren't paying them. So it removes that free rider, as the unions call it, or as I call it, the forced rider issue. It enhances right to work laws, and it gives both employees and employers the ability to have those individualized contracts, and solved one of the main issues that unions have with right to work and with Janus, that workers aren't, that they're forced to represent workers that aren't paying them. So with that, those are the main recommendations that I wanted to talk about today, that opt-in legislation, protecting public employees' First Amendments, union recertification, protecting union democracy, protecting the right to work law that Michigan passed in 2012, workers' choice, protecting that individual choice of workers, and also protecting unions that don't want to represent workers that aren't paying them. There's two other issues that I want to touch on, and I'm happy to get to those questions. The first is union transparency, protecting union members. If you're at all familiar with private sector unions or with federal law, private sector union members are able to see their union finance, their union finances. They're able to see where the union's spending their money, whether it's on representation, politics, salaries, if they're taking out any loans, how much dues are. It's all housed on the Department of Labor on forms such as the form LM2. Unfortunately, that is only for unions with private sector members. It doesn't apply to the public sector members or unions with only public sector members. So they don't file the same type of transparency reports. So what you see is you see this great transparency, private sector unions able to keep their unions accountable, fighting corruption, keeping the unions, representing them, keeping their best interest at heart. But those same rights aren't extended to their public sector brothers and sisters. So union transparency modeled off of the federal law in Michigan for public employees is one of the other ideas for reform. And finally, release time prohibitions, protecting taxpayers. That simply means that if a public employee is receiving a taxpayer-funded salary, they'll be doing their taxpayer-funded job. You see some collective bargaining agreements where a union official can work sometimes full-time, receiving their taxpayer-funded salary, but instead working for the union. So with that, I saw a lot of questions. Can't wait to get to them, but we'll make one plug. And I don't have this fancy on the screen, but if you're interested, the top 20 guide, state level labor reforms guide. We also have a Michigan version, and that is on Mackinac.org, M-A-C-K-I-N-A-C.org. And if anyone is interested in getting this on a hard copy, we'd be happy to send them out to you. So with that, looking forward to going to the chat, and let's see some of these questions. Well, I see a lot of questions from David saying I'm still on my first slide, so thank you, David.
Yep. If it's the main chat room, I think it's mainly questions about Candidate University and then also Olu.
Okay, great.
So, but...
Yeah, I think it is mostly logistical, but happy to take any questions on the slides or on labor law, or just have a good chat because I know we still got some time.
All right. Well, I am going to end the screen share for the moment. So I am not seeing any questions about Vinny's presentation in the chat room, but if there's none else, we'll wrap up a few minutes early. I want to thank all of you. I've got a lot of familiar faces among this group, and certainly appreciate your willingness to spend the time with us over these 6 nights of the program. Once again, the www.mackinac.org/candidate-university is the link to where you can access all of the materials and all of the video of the presentations. And I will also be sending you copies of the email that we send to legislators about twice a month with up news about events and research and the like. We have a couple of events coming up next week, one of which is announced and listed on our website, and the other we're still working on confirming the last speaker. Howard has a question. How are the feds involved in the unions in Michigan?
For the private sector, they are very involved. So basically for all private sector labor law, except for right to work, that is almost entirely coming from Congress, coming from federal statute. Michigan does have a lot of authority and a lot of power when it comes to public sector unions and public employees. But when it comes to the private sector, almost all of that is governed by federal law. So that is the short answer. I mean, happy to get into a lot more of the nitty gritty if you'd like, but short answer is when you think private sector, think federal. When you think public sector, think state.
Okay. All right. Well, if there are no further questions, thank you all for being part of this, and know that all of us wish you well in your races coming up, whether you're on the ballot on August 4th. The 4th is the date, right? Yeah, I think it's the 4th. And for those of you who have a free pass through August into November, and those of you who are fortunate enough to win, we will be back in touch with you regarding a briefing that we will do with you and hopefully some of your new colleagues in December, getting ready for the 101st Michigan Legislature in January. So thanks so much, and look for a survey from me next week. We really want to know what was useful from the program, what we can do better next time. So thanks, everyone. God bless y'all. Best of luck.